Distinguidos delegados, muy buenas tardes.
Distinguished delegates, good afternoon. We will now resume the high-level event of the General Assembly entitled Contributions of Human Rights and the Rule of Law in the Post-2015 Development Agenda. The second panel discussion is entitled Toward a Transformational Development Agenda, Integrating Human Rights and the Rule of Law with a View to Improving Development Outcomes. Members are reminded that the panel discussion will end promptly at 5:15 at the latest, so that we can resume the session with the General President of the General Assembly and go through the final concluding stage.
Quisiera, siguiendo la metodología.
Now, following the schedule that we laid down this morning, I'd like to begin this roundtable with a number of considerations. And I will speak as the moderator. First of all, I'd like to thank the President of the General Assembly for his invitation to moderate this panel. In my opinion, it takes up a fundamental element in our discussions on the post-2015 agenda. It does so in an open and interactive format, as interactive as possible. First of all, I'd like to bid a welcome to the distinguished members of this panel. Ladies and gentlemen, I bid a welcome to you all. And also, I'd like to welcome the representative of states and representatives of organizations of civil society who are with us today. The tremendous event that yesterday's high-level event aroused among everyone and the panels today have aroused shows that the actors have priority in the rule of law and human rights. Also, we are discussing the role to be played but in the agenda post-2015, it must be broad and global and universality. That's something we should always bear in mind. This debate and discussions on the importance of rule of law, good governance, human rights, and development are nothing new. It's nothing new. In Rio Plus 20, just to take this as an example, we said that democracy, good governance, and the rule of law, both at the national and international level, are essential for sustainable development. And that includes, of course, sustainable economic growth, including social development, protection of the environment, and, of course, the eradication of poverty and hunger. Almost 2 years ago, in the High-Level Declaration, the heads of state and government reaffirmed that human rights, the rule of law, and democracy are interrelated. They're mutually strengthening. They are some of the values and fundamental principles, and universal principles and indivisible, of the United Nations. Although time has passed, and we're very clear about the relationship between the rule of law and development, it is also a well-known fact that there are differences of opinion regarding the concrete form that this relationship should take. It should be an enabler of development, and also we should try to identify the role that it can play in identifying goals and objectives in the post-2015 agenda. We must recognize that we're just beginning a discussion that will have to become ever more rich in the coming months. In this debate, we must not be resigned to just elliptical references to human rights and to the rule of law. In the best of cases, such references might only be part of a narrative which we'll agree upon for 2015. The challenge is to keep the agreements that we've reached so far and use it as a frame of reference, and then we must take a great leap forward, a qualitative leap forward. The post-2015 agenda must be global, inclusive, and people-centered, and must recognize the fact that the promotion and respect for human rights and inclusionary policies are universal challenges. These challenges require the leadership of countries and international cooperation, and a number of other speakers have said this. We must know that specific conditions in different countries, historical, cultural contexts in different countries make it impossible, absolutely impossible, for us to think in terms of any kind of conditionality. All countries, whether they be developed or developing, have great challenges when it comes to social inclusion. No one can escape this reality. And this is increasingly cruel, if you wish to use that word. The economic and financial crisis has struck the developed countries too. In the developing countries and in the industrialized world, we must recognize the fact that we are witnessing new expressions of discrimination and social exclusion, which seemed to be something in the past, a number of years ago. But we have important experience in some countries, which confirm, and this is the optimistic note that I'd like to strike, which confirm that there's an important link between human rights, development, and the rule of law. In the case of my country, if I may refer to my country, to Mexico, the history of the past 20 years is a clear demonstration of the fact that the rule of law can be an essential element in achieving sustainable development. Also, it shows the importance of promoting human rights as part of a broader state agenda. In Mexico, over the past two decades, we have seen that there's been a change from an old development model based on imports for an open trade policy and exchange with the rest of the world of goods and services. The change of the economic model led to a change in our political models, and the old political model led to a transition to full democracy and to political alternation, the first ever in my country, in the year 2000. Today, in a country that has experience of the demographic boom of the 1960s, migration from Mexico abroad, but also there have been new migratory flows into Mexico, has been more and more active, and civil society, therefore, has played an active role in this, and the critical free press has played an important role in facing up to Mexican realities. Promotion and respect for human rights in this context have shown that this is a new factor in the new relationship between individuals and the Mexican state. This has transformed the realities of my country. Now my country is a party to almost all treaties having to do with human rights. We're open to dynamic cooperation and daily cooperation with the High Commissioner of the United Nations for Human Rights. We have brought about constitutional and legal reforms of all kinds. We have made efforts to strengthen our institutions and implement international standards. All these things have been attempts to meet the new requirements of society. Of course, we're very far from having reached the end of our efforts. We are trying to strengthen the rule of law and promotion of human rights. However, progress is undeniable. We have legal certainty. Much was made of that this morning. No one can pretend to have foreign investments in our country unless there is legal certainty. Access to good health, access to education, the reform of the system of justice, transparency, accountability, and social inclusion are all important elements in our efforts. What we're trying to achieve is this: sustainable growth, unless we want to promote globalization of indifference, globalization of indifference, as Pope Francis said recently. We've brought about fundamental changes nationally. It's a sine qua non requirement if we can only have a legal framework which will make it possible for us to produce a society of fairness. And there must be rights and obligations of all states. Within the framework of the high-level statement on the rule of law, we tried to make it clear that efforts in this area must include both aspects of the rule of law. Although we are committed to implementing international standards of human rights. Domestically, we also believe it's fundamental that we strengthen the rule of law at the international level. Examples of this are many of the actions that we've taken recently over the past few years. As a number of speakers have quite rightly pointed out, it's an essential element of the rule of law that member states of the United Nations must abide by the obligations that they have under the United Nations Charter and must abide by their treaties and abide by the principles of international law. The global system is a complex interrelationship of legal obligations which encompass subjects including human rights, but also includes trade, the environment, prevention of natural disasters, protection of health, etc. As you will recall in the Declaration of 2012, the rule of law applies equally to all states and to all international organizations, and that would include the United Nations. And it must not be forgotten that this is a fundamental premise of all our discussions. And now, with this introduction, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished delegates, I would like to move on to the discussion and the participation of our panelists within the framework of this roundtable. And I'd also like to give the floor to the Vice Chairman, Foreign Minister of Bosnia-Herzegovina. You have the floor.
Thank you very much. First, I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, Your Excellency, for having a grand opening. And now we have to feel that big space that you just created. And I'll try to, with my intervention, to, let's say a few words about, since this is closing session to a certain extent, and we should answer in a certain way what to do in order to come to the name of our panel. But in order to be more motivating, I would, before saying what we should do, I would say a few words about why we have to do it, then how we have to do it, and on the end, what to do it, because that's how we will motivate people to do what they should do. One of the most quoted books that I, in the last years, that I used in my professional capacity, my political capacity, my academic capacity, was the quote of a great economist who I admire very much, Jeffrey Sachs, who some years ago in his book about global wealth had a very interesting sentence saying, we are living in a time which is a bizarre combination of Stone Age emotions, medieval age beliefs, and almost godlike technologies. The playing with almost godlike technologies actually brought us where we are, when we are facing some challenges that we were not used to. When millennium goals were set, global warming was an academic issue. Well, it was science fiction, movies, subject. Today, and I'm coming from the country which in the last 2 years we actually went through the severest winter in the latest 50 years, through the biggest heat which resulted with the biggest fires of the environment in recent half century, and then we left the country, when I left the country behind us, we had the biggest natural disaster as a result of simple thing which is called rain. Because in the last 120 years, since the rain has been measured in that part of the world, we have never measured such enormous strength of the nature, which we obviously played with. So why we are doing this? First thing why we are doing it is, why it is important and why we have to do this is something which we should, let's say, call at this stage self-sustainability. Self-sustainability is actually why we have to do it, because on the end of the road, what is the real topic that we are talking about is one of the mechanisms what we should do in order to fulfill why we are going in this direction. Of course, some human rights activists will say that human rights are also good to answer by why. But I'll take this a little bit different, in different order. Knowing that human rights are actually in human beings and individuals, and that's how I will conclude with, is actually the most relevant thing under the sky. And there's only one force that is higher and more complex than human beings. Some people call it nature, some people call it God, but we all agree that there's something more complex than us. And we are actually recently been playing with God's games and playing with it. That's the reason why self-sustainability is number one answer to saying why we're doing it. The number two, second point in why we are doing this, we are doing it because we are, as a human beings, we are at the same time so different and at the same time equal. And that being different and being equal at the same time leads us to the conclusion that we have to find the formula in which we will be so different but at the same time equal, and that is called shared society. That we, in our microcosmos, or in global scale, or in regional context, we are sharing the shared society way of living. And the third point in answering why is actually something which economists would kill me if I wouldn't go for that. We are, in human nature, is go for prosperity. And we are doing it because we want to change. We want to prosper. Now, how we should do it? How we should actually fulfill those three answers to whys? First thing is actually how we should achieve it. We should achieve it, and we can achieve it only by creating democratic institutions and capacities. And with this, creating environment which has three key elements. First one is rule of law as a tool of human rights. I know I'm a little bit simplifying the things, but I just, so forgive me for my maybe a little bit improper comparison. But rule of law is actually not what is the final goal. The final goal is to fulfill human rights according to the values that we are talking about. Rule of law is mechanism or the tool for fulfilling. And how we will go for it will go by rule of law. The second element of how creating democratic institutions. So democratic institutions consist of rule of law and, of course, out of economic competitiveness. Mechanisms for governance of economic competitiveness. Because without economic competitiveness, one great man taught me a long time ago that as far as he figured out on the end of his political career as studying history, that all great nations were becoming greater and greater, establishing themselves, going further, and in the end declining or even disappearing, not because they lost the wars, but because they lost economic power in that historical context. So economic competitiveness and governance of economic competitiveness is the second element of how we should do it. And the third element is administrative governance. Administrative governance in the sense of building institutions which will be complementary with rule of law, with economic competitiveness, and actually being in the service of human rights and economic competitiveness. One of the greatest democrats of latest end of 20th century, Václav Havel, who was known as probably he had a lot of similarities with Leonardo, because at the time of Leonardo da Vinci, you could know everything. But Havel was one of the most multi-practical, multi-purpose men who knew so many things, from poetry to governance and leadership and being good men. In his famous Ottawa speech, I'm just paraphrasing it, because he was the man who was symbolizing the changing institutions after the fall of Berlin Wall. And he reminded us in that speech, in much better words than I will do it, that we as the most complex invention of Mother Nature or the God are the ones who created institutions. And by definition, you cannot create something which is more complex than yourself. The conclusion, institutions will never be so safe against human beings and their creativity. So that's the reason why I'm going to the last point is what we have to do. And what we have to do is we have to invest in human capacity by building three core elements. First ones, otherwise we are not investing and we are not creating human capacity. We are creating unhuman capacity if that capacity is not driven by sense of solidarity, equality, and freedom. And point number two, if that human capacity doesn't have enough skills, strengths, expertise in order to prosper. And the third element of human capacity is moral and ethic values-driven human capacity, which we keep forgetting because it looks like we are still, as my introductory line was, we are still sometimes living in Stone Age emotions and medieval age beliefs, which you have to lift up or scale down technology, because otherwise that gap is going to be disastrous. Can we do it? Can we do it? The answer is very simple. And I'll end with a quote of much smarter man than I was, and I still am, who said a long time ago that if you think that you can, or if you think that you cannot, you are right. So yes, we think that we can, and I'm sure that we are right. I even don't want to think about possibility that we think that we cannot, because I don't want us to be right by thinking that we cannot do it. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak on this topic.
Muchísimas gracias.
Thank you very much. Mr. Minister, I think there's a broad area of agreement between the two of us. As I prepared myself, I also used Jeffrey Sachs in another text that I recently prepared. Thank you, Mr. Minister, too, for reminding us about global challenges such as global warming and the terrible events that your country recently had to go through, unfortunately, in daily life. People are affected by these events, and also countries are affected as they try to give their citizens what they legitimately deserve. We should remember this. It is the state that loses its ability to react, its reactive ability, every time there are these natural disasters which are anthropogenic, caused by man. It's not just something that happens out there. It's these disasters are caused by man. And also, sir, I'd like to thank you for placing emphasis on human capacity. This is something that really deserves emphasis, human capacity. Human capacity, those words sum up very well the tools, the instruments that we want to give people so that people can truly be masters of their own destiny, so that they can be masters of their own development. Also, I have to say that I agree with you that in the end, what we're really talking about is we have to be guided by moral and ethical values. And quoting Jeffrey Sachs again, we have to talk about sustainable mankind, as you said, sir. And now, I'd like to give the floor to Mrs. Sarwati Menon, the director of the policy division of this great institution, which is in charge of women. And I'd also like to give the floor, in a sense, to the public. We should have an interactive exchange, and then we will speak with the panelists. Madam Menon, you have the floor.
Mr. Chairman, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, it is an honor to be with you today. Let me start by expressing my gratitude to you, Mr. Chairman, and to His Excellency Ambassador Ash for organizing this high-level meeting on human rights and the rule of law in the post-2015 development agenda, and for your leadership in reinforcing the message that human rights are central for the post-2015 development agenda. We have heard a loud and clear demand from all regions in the world that human rights standards and principles should be firmly integrated into our next development agenda. We have heard this message from over 1 million people in the global and thematic consultations that were held over the last few years. Member states have recognized this imperative in the Millennium Declaration of 2000 and in the 2012 Rio Plus 20 outcome document, which reaffirmed the importance of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Member states also recognize, as we just heard, from their own national experience, the centrality of human rights in sustainable development. And we have seen a growing consensus that this be a priority of the new goals, including in the work of the Open Working Group on Sustainable Development Goals. The question now, therefore, is no longer if human rights should be included in the new agenda, but how? And this is the question that we are here to discuss today. I would like to make 4 points in this regard. First, we must have a holistic understanding of human rights. Human rights include economic, social, and cultural rights, as well as civil and political rights and the right to development. The new framework must comprehensively reflect all human rights to ensure both freedom from want, human rights relating to the workplace, social security, family life, participation in cultural life, and access to housing, food, water, sanitation, healthcare, and education, and freedom from fear, human rights relating to access to justice, participation in public affairs, personal security, and free expression, association, and assembly. The indivisibility of rights is key because the challenges faced by people are complex and interconnected. For example, the right to food is linked with women's access to land and access to water, as well as access to affordable energy sources to process and prepare food and to have the time to do all this work. It is clear that human rights should be intimately linked with all goals, targets, and indicators, and not be set apart in a standalone goal. We have already seen evidence of this understanding in the drafts of the Open Working Group, which articulate that a goal on education, for example, should be related to the right to education, and that the targets underpinning it should reflect key human rights elements such as availability, accessibility, affordability, and quality of education. The right to education entails more than building schools. It means ensuring a quality education for all people without discrimination and ensuring schools that are safe for girls and provide sanitary facilities so that all can have equal opportunities for a life of human dignity. This also means that goals and targets on governance and the rule of law should reflect the human rights elements and aim to protect personal security, secure high standards in the administration of justice, and protect people's rights to participate in political and public life. And this means that ensuring a new framework is universally applicable because there is no country that is immune to poverty, inequality, and discrimination. Second, it will be critical to ground the new agenda on the human rights principles of equality and non-discrimination. Many types of inequalities have worsened since the Millennium Declaration was adopted. At present, the richest 1% of the world's population owns 40% of global assets, while the bottom half owns just 1%. The success of the MDGs rode on the back of widening social and economic inequalities both within and among countries. Inequalities are not just problems for the people whose lives are most directly affected, those who are most disadvantaged and marginalized. They have broader consequences for society and harm us all. Higher levels of inequality make it more difficult for economic growth to be translated into poverty reduction. And inequalities weaken social cohesion and security, often feeding political intolerance, xenophobia, and violence. It is critical that the imperative of equality should underpin the entire framework, and the framework should provide the impetus to end inequality and discrimination in our lifetime. The new framework should move beyond formal equality to substantive equality, challenge structural impediments such as unequal power relations, unequal resources, and systemic biases that perpetuate inequalities and disparities. The new framework should commit to end, not just reduce, but reduce to zero conditions such as poverty, violence, preventable deaths, malnutrition, and the denial of basic service access. It should ensure that all stakeholders, including marginalized, disempowered, and excluded groups, have a say in developing the new agenda, in setting priorities, and in holding decision makers accountable to achieve those priorities. One of the failings of the MDGs was the focus on averages and on aggregate progress, which ignored how progress bypassed the poorest and most marginalized. The new framework must therefore ensure that data is disaggregated by social groups for all goals, targets, and indicators, and ensure that progress is monitored for each group to ensure that no one is left behind. Otherwise, we will continue to be trapped in averages which hide the real lives and aspirations of people. The framework should include explicit targets not only to reduce inequalities, but also to eliminate all forms of discrimination. We are very pleased to see that in the current draft of the Open Working Group, there are two proposed goals, one on gender equality and another on promoting equality, more broadly to address other kinds of social, economic, and environmental inequalities. Gender equality, women's rights, and women's empowerment must be central to the new framework because gender inequality and discrimination are the most pervasive violation of human rights. There is widespread acknowledgement that women's empowerment and gender equality are essential to environmental, social, and economic progress. However, across the many consultations that have been held, it is clear that women feel less safe, less listened to, and less counted in statistics than men. In UN Women, we, together with many others, think that gender equality and women's empowerment and rights must be addressed in a standalone goal which addresses three core areas. First, freedom from violence for women and girls. Second, equality in human capabilities, access to opportunities and resources. And third, equality in agency, voice, and participation across the full range of decision-making arenas, be they public or private institutions. In addition to this, we would also call for gender concerns and targets to be comprehensively integrated across all goals. It is important that other goals, such as those on poverty, health, education, hunger, and food security, water and sanitation, and so on, include gender-specific targets and indicators, and not just disaggregation of standard indicators. For instance, distance to water source is a gender-sensitive indicator because women and girls usually do the fetching. Third, the new agenda must include a strong accountability framework which identifies rights holders and corresponding duty bearers, as well as mechanisms at the international, national, and local levels. Such a framework must hold all states, developed and developing alike, accountable for their commitments in a universal agenda while taking into account the different levels of development of member states. With the growth of public-private partnerships and the increasing involvement of the private sector in development, it will be important to ensure responsible business practices through the exercise of due diligence and the use of human rights impact assessments. Fourth and lastly, human rights are relevant not only at the national level but also at the international level, through commitments to the right to development and to international cooperation in accordance with the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. To secure a national and international order in which all human rights can be realized, Human rights can help to guide and shape a goal on global partnership and the means of implementation. This means extending human rights with the rule of law to the international level, including through democratizing the institutions of international governance for the full participation of all member states. In addition, it means international cooperation to secure an international environment that is conducive to the realization of human rights, including ensuring policy space and coherence so that international trade, finance, investment, and intellectual property agreements are consistent with and respectful of human rights. In closing, Mr. Chairman, let me reiterate that in order to put human rights at its core, the new framework must address human rights holistically, be grounded on the principles of equality and non-discrimination, have a strong accountability framework, and ensure that at the national and international level, human rights are respected and promoted. Only then can we ensure real progress for all women and men and girls and boys. Thank you very much.
Agradezco a la doctora.
I thank Dr. Sarawati Menon for her comments in the context of this panel discussion. I do think it's worthwhile picking up from what she said that this can't be summed up by our saying, should we or should we not integrate human rights? The question is, how can we do what we should do? How? That's the starting point that should guide us all. I think exercising considerable vision, she was quite right in reminding us of the indivisibility of rights. Yes, we're talking about whether we should first realize economic, social, and cultural rights and then civil and political rights, or vice versa. That's a debate which I think belongs to the past. We've gone beyond that. It's been analyzed in the United Nations. We must remember that ever since 1993 in the Vienna Conference, we committed ourselves to the indivisibility of rights and the interrelationship of all human rights, including the right to development. I was also glad that Dr. Menon reminded us of the fact that in spite of some progress, inequalities have been growing since the year 2000, and perhaps the best way of dealing with this is as follows. We can note the new forms of violence which exist today. Domestic violence, such as something we have never experienced before, both in the developed and developing countries. New forms of violence in interpersonal relations, very often in the early stages of relationships between two people between the age of 15 and 16, there's violence. Sometimes there's violence too. Within a couple, there's sexual harassment, which is overwhelming today. It's a new form of violence in the educational arena, but it reminds us of violence that exists within the home. And all this should lead us to thinking that we have to, in the end, give ourselves real machinery for accountability. And this should lead to renewed international cooperation, as Dr. Menon reminded us quite rightly. And then we have to review matters in human rights. Only a couple of years ago, this seemed unthinkable, but reviews have worked. Reviews have worked. We just need an additional international effort to support countries who need assistance in complying with recommendations that they receive from the Council on Human Rights. Now, presuming with our discussion, I would like to give the floor to the distinguished representative of Japan, who was unable to participate in the debate yesterday. Japan now has the floor.
Oh, perdón. Es el distinguido representante.
It is the distinguished representative of Japan. I thought it was a lady who represented you, sir, but I call on you.
Very much, Chair. I also would like to thank the distinguished panelists and discuss them for their informative and inspiring discussions. I actually prepared to make a statement for this event. I would just point out several things which might be relevant to the discussion now, and would distribute the statement through the PaperSmart. Here I would like to point out two issues. The first one is that, as Mr. Chair also pointed out, that the establishment of the rule of law and the protection of the human rights can be seen as outcome of development, but this outcome can itself attract greater development. Historically speaking, the most prosperous era of my country came with the promotion of human rights and the rule of law. The second thing which I want to point out is relates to our development cooperation policy. Japan will commemorate the 60th anniversary of its ODA this year. We have been putting emphasis on cooperating with partners that are making active efforts to pursue peace, democratization, and protection of human rights, as well as structural reform in the economic, social spheres. This is because our philosophy is to support the ownership of our partner countries based on good governance. Of course, these efforts require tireless, long-term efforts, and at the same time, each country's sovereignty, unique culture, and values must be taken into account. In addition, we also consider that extending cooperation to the efforts for pursuing the rule of law and protection of human rights will benefit the promotion of human security. Taking account to these kind of issues I mentioned, my delegation aligns itself with the statement delivered yesterday by the distinguished permanent representative of Austria on behalf of the group of the rule of law. We support the rule of law cut across all aspects of sustainable development, and it is therefore crucial that it is strongly embedded through the post-2015 development agenda. And as for the targets, we think that areas such as access to justice, accountability, institution, anti-corruption, freedom of media, association and speech, legal identity, inter alia, would be important. Thank you very much.
I thank the distinguished representative of Japan for his comments, and I thank you for having reminded us of the centrality of the concept of human security. We coined that concept at the summit conference. It's really a key element in what we're trying to achieve with the post-2015 agenda. Now, I call on the distinguished representative of the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance. You have the floor.
Muchas gracias, señor presidente.
Thank you very much, sir.
As an intergovernmental organization working to support sustainable democracy globally, International IDEA welcomes today's event. There is a wide and broad consensus on the interlinkages between democracy, human rights, and the rule of law, and their contribution to development. The post-2015 development agenda should strive to consistently operationalize such dimensions throughout the new framework. There is no single model of democracy. Democracy does not belong to any country or region, and yet the principles of democracy are universal. The universal nature of democracy as something which people all over the world aspire to is clear from citizens' own actions and demands for democracy. In the spirit of this high-level event, I would like to identify three key areas. Firstly, enhance the role of democracy, human rights, and the rule of law in the new framework. The ongoing global conversation on the post-2015 development agenda has in many ways stressed the need to strengthen democratic accountability throughout the new framework. We hope that member states will achieve consensus on a balanced framework that recognizes the importance of democratic governance both as a goal and an enabler. We believe in particular that democratic governance should be a standalone goal in the new framework with specific targets on key dimensions of participation, transparency and accountability, many of which are being addressed within the Open Working Group on Sustainable Development Goals. Secondly, develop a target for elections integrity. According to the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, genuine and periodic elections shall form the basis of government. Elections with integrity are critical to respect and promote the genuine nature of elections. This could well become a target in the post-2015 development framework. Building up of national capacity to conduct elections with integrity is clearly critical, as is the need for more concerted international attention on this issue. When elections lack integrity, they fail to be the essential building block of democracy, which they need to be. According to the recommendations of the Global Commission on Democracy, Elections and Security, when elections have integrity, they bolster democracy, respect human rights, and produce elected officials, women and men, who are more likely to represent their citizens' interests. Thirdly, democratic accountability should be a key concern of the post-2015 development framework. Democratic accountability refers to the many ways in which citizens, political parties, parliaments, and other democratic actors can provide feedback to, reward, or sanction officials in charge of setting and delivering public services. Democratic accountability in public service delivery requires to address a double democratic challenge: to strengthen formal and legal mechanisms that allow citizens, women and men, to articulate and voice their policy concerns, and to encourage elected representatives and public officials and employees to effectively respond to the provision of public services. As part of the process of demanding accountability, the post-2015 development agenda should recognize the importance of the creation of a civic space for constructive engagement and dialogue between political actors, service providers, and citizens about potential reforms. In that perspective, the capacities of citizens as right holders to make their claims and the capacities of state institutions as duty bearers to meet their obligations should be strengthened. The full version of my statement will be made available in the paper Smart Portal. I thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the distinguished representative of International IDEA for his comments, and I now call on the distinguished representative of the International Labour Organization, and then we will return to our panelists.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moderator, for giving the International Labour Organization the opportunity to contribute. And let me thank you and the panelists for setting the context for our discussion today. As the international standard-setting institution of the world of work, the International Labour Organization wishes to highlight the core role of the right to work and of rights at work as transformational components of sustainable development. This role has been recognized so far by the Open Working Group through the consideration of possible targets on respective workers' rights and safety, in particular for migrant workers, the eradication of child labour, and adoption of non-discriminatory practices, including equal pay for work of equal value. As you know, the world faces the double challenge of creating more than 670 million jobs over the coming 15 years, especially for youth, and of improving the quality of jobs for around 50% of the labor force who are still in vulnerable employment. Economic growth is a necessary but not sufficient condition for the creation of quality jobs, and it must be accompanied by institutions, legal and policy frameworks that simultaneously protect the rights of workers, promote more equitable income distribution, and favor a conducive environment for business development and job creation. The adoption of adequate national labor laws and regulations, as well as the strengthening of labor inspection and labor institutions, including effective labor resolution mechanisms, are fundamental means of implementation for international labor standards, guaranteeing decent work, and supporting the rule of law. The promotion of workers' rights means better development outcomes. After analyzing the economic performance of over 140 countries, the recent International Labour Organization's publication, The World of Work 2014, found that countries that invested in improving the quality as well as the quantity of jobs increased their productivity and economic performance. Special attention should be given to the fundamental rights at work, including the eradication of child labor, forced labor, and discrimination, as well as the exercise of freedom of association and collective bargaining. As we celebrate the World Day Against Child Labor on the 12th of June, the same day as the beginning of the World Cup, the ILO is relaunching its Red Card to Child Labor campaign. You'll know that an estimated 168 million child laborers worldwide can be found toiling in the sweatshops and mines, on construction sites and on farms. Some are recruited as child soldiers, others as drug traffickers, some are sexually exploited, and the ILO's Red Card to Child Labor campaign gives voice to those children. There's also a need to improve legislation and implement measures to promote occupational safety and health, and to reduce the number of work-related accidents. Last year, 2.3 million workers lost their lives due to work injuries. Work accidents are among the top five leading causes of death in the world and is truly a hidden epidemic. Finally, let me also highlight the need to promote fair rules for labor migration and to protect the rights of migrant workers. Migration can generate enormous benefits to both sending and receiving countries if an adequate legal and institutional framework is in place. The ILO, as chair of the Global Migration Group, has been working together with 16 international organizations to promote decent work on the move and ultimately to bring about a fairer and safer international migration system. Thank you very much.
I thank the distinguished representative of the ILO, the International Labour Organization, for her statement and for having reminded us of the new forms of slavery which exist today because of child labor. And she spoke about the conditions of migrant workers and their families. If we don't deal with these needs, we will not make any progress in this area. If you allow me, I'd like to turn to our panelists and ask our distinguished panelists, Mr. James Goldston, Executive Director of Open Society Justice Initiative. Sir, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Minister, fellow panelists, distinguished representatives, ladies and gentlemen. It's a privilege and an honor to contribute to this most important discussion. My organization, the Open Society Justice Initiative, works to promote human rights and the rule of law around the world. At the same time, we've been centrally engaged in this debate about the next global development agenda. Over the past year, member states working through the Open Working Group have made much progress, and yet a major question remains. What role will justice play in the next generation of development goals? For people around the globe, it is no secret that the rule of law, good governance, and human rights are necessary preconditions to peaceful, stable, prosperous societies. The day-to-day consequences of barriers to justice are real. Without secure property rights or means for claiming them, poor people cannot invest. Without reliable and responsive criminal justice institutions, people do not feel safe to send their children to school or to go to market to trade. Without legal identity, one cannot access services, open a bank account, or in some countries, even acquire a mobile phone. Rule of law deficits, corruption, armed conflict, inefficient public institutions perpetuate poverty and inequality. And it's not only people who see the link between justice and development. States get it too. Just last September, the General Assembly affirmed that the rule of law is of fundamental importance for the further development of the three main pillars upon which the United Nations is built: international peace and security, human rights, and development. In short, we now understand that justice and governance are no less important to equitable and sustainable development than good schools, functioning health clinics, or passable roads. And yet, what do we do with this knowledge? How concretely do we integrate justice and governance into the development agenda? I'll address these questions in three ways. First, to recall the many positive impacts that justice and good governance have had on development already. Secondly, to discuss how justice and governance can be incorporated into targets in the new development framework. And finally, I'd like to respond briefly to the concern that justice and governance are not measurable. In 2011, the World Bank's World Development Report heralded an end to the long divide between the worlds of justice and development. This landmark study found that addressing injustice and insecurity is fundamental to poverty reduction. And in the years since, the evidence of links between justice and development has only expanded. Just a few weeks ago, the legal empowerment organization NAMATI, which Open Society Foundations supports, published a comprehensive evaluation of nearly 200 access to justice and social accountability programs. The findings are striking. When government and civil society groups support people to understand and claim their legal rights, development processes are not only more inclusive and equitable, they also drive better health, stronger educational outcomes, and wealthier communities. Let me just offer a few examples. Over the course of 1 year, in 25 villages in Uganda, the government, the World Bank, and local organizations partnered to improve health outcomes by fostering greater community engagement in health service provision. Armed with more information about health policies, local residents developed scorecards rating the performance of health clinics and met with service providers. And in just 1 year, under five mortality was 33% lower, vaccination rates improved, and community members utilized more health services with lower waiting times. In Mozambique and in Liberia, community-based paralegals have contributed to more secure and equitable governance of land and to resolving intracommunal and territorial disputes. In Bangladesh, efforts focused on raising women's awareness of rights and responsibilities around marriage have been reported to help decrease the size and frequency of illegal dowry payments. In Ecuador, the expansion of access to legal information and advice has helped address physical violence against women. Legal identity documentation has been found to be a determining factor for social, economic, and political exclusion for men and women. And several projects underway, including in Kenya, in the Dominican Republic, in Macedonia, successfully deploy low-cost, community-based paralegal schemes to secure legal identity documents, including birth certificates and identification cards, which are essential for access to citizenship, education, and health care. In Ontario, Canada, the provincial government allocates funds for independent community legal service centers to provide advice to citizens to promote healthier and safer livelihoods. In short, while models of collaboration between government and civil society vary from place to place, the principles remain the same, north and south, east and west. Projects which promote justice and enhance the rule of law concretely foster more equitable, inclusive, and sustainable development. Now, given the essential connections between justice and development, how do we actually incorporate these linkages into the post-2015 framework? In fact, many governments are already doing so through targets contained in their own national plans. Indonesia has adopted numerous economic reforms and developed robust safety net policies in recent years that have helped drive poverty alleviation. Two specific targets on justice in Indonesia's medium-term development plan for 2010 to 2014 commit the government to increase the number of justice seekers who report comfort, security, and security in their interaction with the state, and to increase the trust and respect the general public have for law enforcement and government justice institutions. South Africa is another example. In 2010, President Zuma tasked the National Planning Commission to develop a national development plan to guide South Africa's progress. The commission concluded that justice, safety, and good governance are central to South Africa's efforts to eliminate poverty and reduce inequality. And the 2030 development plan includes specific commitments to realize a developmental, capable, and ethical state that treats citizens with dignity. And Indonesia and South Africa are not unique. Across the world, government-led poverty reduction strategies and development plans include targets on justice, governance, and safety. Afghanistan's poverty reduction strategy from 2008, the blueprint for government and donor policy, included a goal to ensure that the public can rely on effectively organized and professionally staffed, transparent and accountable justice institutions. As far back as 2001, Honduras incorporated justice and governance into its development plan. In 2005, Mongolia adopted a ninth development goal to strengthen human rights and foster democratic governments with three targets and 12 monitoring indicators. Many other countries have followed suit. Now, the Secretary General's high-level panel, the Open Working Group, and others have offered suggestions for potential targets in the new development framework. I'd like to use this opportunity to put forward a few concrete recommendations. And these targets are contained in a statement that has been developed by over 200 civil society organizations from 50 countries. And they've been endorsed by, among others, Desmond Tutu and former presidents of Brazil, Mexico, and the United States. Government should ensure that access to legal identity is universal and that all people can participate fully in society. A target could be to ensure that no one suffers from a lack of legal identity. Government should ensure communities and individuals, including women, have secure rights to land and property. And a target could be to increase the amount of land for which communities have secure tenure and decisions are taken through an open and accountable process. Or to increase the share of women, men, and communities with secure rights to land and property. People should know about the laws and regulations that govern their lives, particularly concerning essential services. So, a target could be to guarantee the public's right to information and to access government data. And finally, citizens must have a role in shaping the fundamental everyday work of their governments. So, a target could be to ensure the participation of citizens in monitoring essential services, including water, health care, and access to education. Now, having demonstrated the connection between justice and development and describing some possible ways to incorporate these linkages through targets, I'll conclude by responding to the most frequently voiced concern that I've heard in these debates, that justice, desirable though it may be, is just not measurable. In fact, governments have a long tradition of using indicators to monitor progress towards justice and governance. Ministries of justice and judiciaries regularly gather administrative data on case volume and duration. Security agencies and departments of health track homicide and crime statistics. National statistics offices regularly include justice, legal knowledge, and access questions in surveys to document the lived experiences and perceptions of people. Dozens of governments collect information on birth registration rates, and many increasingly have full or partial data on the registration of children. To be sure, governments do not and should not tackle the challenges of measurement alone. Academia, civil society, and international organizations often help. The Afro and Latino barometers are independent, nonpartisan research projects that record experiential data through population-based surveys throughout these regions. UNICEF helps governments collect national data on birth registration and legal identity. UNODC supports national data collection around homicides and conviction rates in more than 80 countries. And the OECD and the World Bank are working with the G7 Plus to develop ways to measure justice and security across many of the world's fragile states. Because a single indicator is often insufficient, governments and academics are increasingly creating baskets of indicators that capture progress across different dimensions through various data sources. Administrative indicators that document government effort and inputs, objective indicators that identify broad trends over time, and experience and perception indicators typically gathered through surveys that ensure that the real experiences of people inform overall assessments. In support of the governance goal in its existing MDG national plan, the government of Mongolia has adopted a basket of indicators, including the following four: government performance in the Human Development Index, expert evaluation of the conformity of Mongolian laws with international human rights treaties, public perception of the political, economic, and financial independence of mass media, and finally, the number of state organizations that regularly place reports of their state budgets and expenditures on their websites. Other G7 Plus countries, including Timor-Leste, Solomon Islands, Liberia and Somalia are also developing baskets of indicators to track progress across a range of peace-building and state-building goals. These include the number of violent deaths per 100,000 and public confidence in the performance of justice systems, both formal and customary, including human rights mechanisms. In short, many governments now recognize that experiential and perception data are valuable tools to help them target programs for effective service delivery. So, over the last 15 years, the MDGs have enabled us to make significant progress as a global community towards eliminating extreme poverty. By including justice and the rule of law in the next generation of Millennium Development Goals, we can do even better. Specific targets and measurable indicators are available. It's time to put them to use. Thank you very much.
Agradezco muchísimo al...
I thank Mr. James Goldstein very much indeed for his very persuasive participation in this roundtable meeting. The role of justice is clearly not an abstract concept, as he has just shown. More than a conditionality, as others have said, it's a precondition of development. He has given us this enormous number of examples of public policies of a very diverse range of countries. He mentioned them. All of this shows very clearly that these goals are measurable. They can be measured. States are measuring them in a regular way. We can talk about the right to identity. There's the subject of legal resources that we all should have access to. I'd also like to thank him for his very useful recommendations, which are not just for us, really. They're for the working group, which is beginning its negotiations on the development agenda. I think it's worth mentioning something that Mr. Goldstein said. In the end analysis, access to public information or governmental information has radically changed relationships between the state and citizen and the citizens in those countries that have produced this kind of information. This is because governments have become open. It's also a way of combating corruption, which so many others have mentioned in this debate. This is a fundamental part of our development agenda. So in the end, thank you very much for reminding us that we can measure these objectives. This is a very encouraging message as we will be pursuing our negotiations toward the end of this year. I now call on our last panelist, Madam Amal Albasha, Chairman of the Sister Arabs Forum for Human Rights, and then directly thereafter, we will open our discussion with the support of our colleague, Never Frashil, who is the analyst of the Catholic Organization for Development.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to make my presentation in Arabic, if you allow me. So please put on your headset so that you can follow me, please. Sayyidul Rais.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the General Assembly of the United Nations, ladies and gentlemen, members of international organizations, distinguished guests, thank you for affording me this opportunity to contribute to the General Assembly high-level event on contribution of human rights and the rule of law, and including them among the topics of the post-2015 development agenda. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Amal Albasha. I am from Yemen, and I represent the Arab Sisters Forum for Human Rights and the Women's Coalition 20, post-2015. For the post-2015 development agenda. Distinguished people in attendance, let me assure you that development and its goals cannot be a substantive matter except if it is included in the human rights agenda and the dignity of people. This is the responsibility of all development players who participate in the responsibility, different as the levels of this responsibility may be. In this regard, it is vital that the post-2015 Sustainable Development Goals Agenda addresses the root causes of human rights violations at all times, in peace and conflict, and its various impacts on all levels and categories, especially women and children and little girls and those who are excluded. Ladies and gentlemen, it is critical that the future development agenda be explicitly shaped and grounded in human rights, environmental sustainability, ensuring gender equality and the realization of women's rights and women's empowerment. Human rights can only be realized if we also reduce the growing inequalities of wealth, power, and resources. It cannot be denied, as indicated by live experiences, that human rights violations and the absence of justice and accountability represent a foundation for instability, conflict, and wars. Here, we must affirm that peoples, including women, cannot lead lives free and want unless states invest in peace building, not in armaments, rather reducing expenditure on armaments while increasing investments in the public sector in the service of development and its aims. Ladies and gentlemen, the growing extremist religious fundamentalism and its wide influence in the world affects the levels, the values of tolerance and coexistence among various peoples and cultures of the world. It encourages the growth of hatred and violence, and also poses a danger to safety and security, including its threat to human rights, especially the rights of women and girls. Putting an end to gender violence and discrimination must be at the heart of development agenda, human rights, and rule of law as interlinked issues. Finally, we hope that the future development agenda will seek to link existing human rights accountability mechanisms at the regional, national, and global levels, stimulate transparency and participation in decision-making at all levels, including the judiciary, human rights institutions, treaty committees, and the full international review on the international level, and also ICJ, and the promoting the accession to the Rome Statute. Serious treatment of various structural causes for inequality and poverty and the environmental deterioration while providing adequate resources and building human capacities while setting moral standards, foremost among which are the values of sound governance, as stressed by the previous speaker. Finally, also, human rights must be considered with the same standard by the international community, because this also will be a guarantee and protection of human rights and deter the repeated violations. As participant coming from the more inflamed region of the Middle East and what the so-called countries of the Arab Spring, I would like to say our spring has become a hot summer where the degrees of temperature vary from one country to the other. Therefore, it is very difficult to speak about development now in this bloody conflict and in view of all the cards that are mingled in inflaming positions and in bloodshed. And the question becomes a luxury. Speaking of development now, while our lives are at stake and our survival is at stake, and there is a state perhaps of silence or complicity even, and maybe there is a kind of mobilization to keep this area as a theater of bloody conflict, the price for which is paid by women, children, civilians, and peaceful citizens. Therefore, the values of peace and love must be promoted among the various international players. And we, as women, we only have the peace option. We greatly depend on this international organization, which has assisted many women to access their rights with its technical support and with its contributions to make the women's rights and the civil society organizations a voice heard in that region, and has achieved also various achievements and successes. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Agradezco muchísimo.
I thank Madam Abbas-Shad for her very important participation in this meeting. Like Dr. Menon, she has very rightly referred to the rights of women and the reduction of inequalities. We have to do this if we want to get to the roots of the problems of human rights. Much of the instability, political and social instability in the world, both within countries and internationally, is due to violations of rights. The analysis of our conflicts over the past 40 years has a common denominator. These conflicts often originate in some sort of major violation of human rights. Often, violations are against a given group, given human group. And obviously, and I thank you, Madam, for having mentioned the importance of this, that states exercising accountability must submit to the jurisdiction of international tribunals. That is something which continues to be a matter that is pending before many, many countries who are members of the United Nations. And now we've come to the end of these presentations by the distinguished panelists. Once again, I'd like to thank the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Bosnia-Herzegovina, who was obliged to leave the room on a trip, the Minister of Foreign Affairs and Fundamental Freedoms of Guinea, is with us, but I don't want to talk about a moderator, maybe the stimulator of debate, the representative of the Catholic Agency for Development will encourage us and lead the debate of the distinguished participants. You have the floor.
General Assembly for the invitation to participate in this high-level event on human rights and the rule of law. My name is Neva Freshville, and I'm the lead policy analyst on post-2015 for CAFOD, a UK development agency. The points that I'm going to share today and the reflections that I bring to this debate come from our work with our partners around the world and the Global Civil Society Campaign Beyond 2015, and also PARTICIPATE, a global participatory research initiative which seeks to bring the perspectives of people living in poverty directly into the post-2015 agenda. I'd particularly like to welcome the remarks that have been made by the fellow panelists here today, Saraswati Menon, James Goldston, and Amal Bashar, who've really pointed out some of the key issues that we have to address as we hope to move towards a more sustainable future for the people who need it most. Many member states and panelists have realized that to be fundamentally transformative, the post-2015 development agenda needs to be people-centered. One of the lessons learned from the MDGs experience is that a siloed approach does not work and that development cannot be one size fits all. If we do not recognize and respond to the diverse contexts and realities that people exist in, we will be at best ineffective and at worst harmful. This means that the post-2015 development agenda should be providing goals and targets which facilitate people to direct their own development pathway, not imposing a top-down development agenda. This means reaching out to people where they are and allowing a shift in power dynamics to take place at the local level between government officials and grassroots communities, between citizens and the national state, and here at the international level. But what does this mean in terms of a practical application of a global development framework consisting of a specific, limited number of goals, targets, and indicators? The recommendations and reflections that I put forwards here today are garnered from participatory processes with people experiencing poverty, exclusion, marginalization, and vulnerability because of factors such as economic status, disability, ethnicity, sexuality, age, gender, and many more. Together, we have worked to set what we see as the moral compass for the post-2015 framework. I'll present 6 points that will enable the framework to be people-centered and to deliver human rights and rule of law that work for the poorest. The first point that I make is that we need to prioritize development investment, which starts with the needs of the poorest and most marginalized people. As a global community, we have a responsibility to listen to those whose lives are most difficult and make their interests a priority. Secondly, we need to give marginalized groups the opportunity to define the rights that matter most to them. Many poor and marginalized groups see rights as a crucial means to delivering equality and dignity. The rights that they prioritize reflect the deficits that they feel most keenly in their own lives. For some, rights provide a pathway to recognition of their status as human beings and citizens. For example, children in Kenya who have disabilities interpreted their invisibility to policymakers as a lack of respect for their rights. For others, rights have a more material dimension. In Ghana, young people told us that they prioritize their right to education, to food, and to shelter. Thirdly, we must protect the rights called for by the poorest and most marginalized within legal frameworks. The concept of rights is central to any attempt to address deep-rooted inequalities. Yet while formal recognition of rights in law is a critical milestone, it does not automatically translate into concrete outcomes. Enshrining rights in law is a crucial first step, but they must be implemented through the transformation of discriminatory norms and values. And this takes us on to our fourth point, that we must target institutional discrimination and ensure that government representatives and officials treat all people with respect. Through research with our partners in Uganda, the Philippines, Bolivia, and Zimbabwe, CAFOD has seen the power of the MDGs to change and challenge discriminatory social norms, representing a considerable improvement for specific groups of marginalized people, previously marginalized people, such as those living with HIV or indigenous peoples. Fifthly, we need to involve citizens in creating, monitoring, and implementing the post-2015 development framework. A participatory approach to governance is one which engages with local knowledges, strengthens people's voices, and enables people to influence decisions and hold decision makers to account, thereby improving national ownership and accountability. While this approach can benefit many, it must be targeted to ensure that it is inclusive of those who are usually excluded so that no one is left behind. And sixth, finally, we must ensure that indicators are directly linked to positive impacts for the poorest and most marginalized, and that no progress can be achieved unless it is realized by all relevant social and income groups. A central desire that has been articulated by people around the world is that they want to be able to play a part in shaping the decisions that guide their lives and develop their futures, and in shaping the policy and programs that affect them. This needs to be at the heart of the post-2015 framework. People have clearly shown that they want to be part of identifying the solutions with policymakers and practitioners. Not only should we be hearing people's call for the right to participate in decisions that affect them, we should also be recognizing that their participation is essential to ensuring good outcomes and effective implementation of the post-2015 development agenda. For many people, human rights are a pathway to development. As one research participant from Brazil commented, "The counterpoint to my poverty is dignity. It should be a compass to show us the way. I have a right to dignity." But building effective, accountable, and legitimate institutions is not just an issue for conflict countries, but for all countries. The post-2015 development agenda must be universal. Effective and resilient societies and state institutions build trust between the state and the population. As this is a universal framework, it will be as relevant to me and my communities in the UK as it will be to those of our partners around the world. Like all people, I want a government that is open, accessible, and inclusive, that enables me to trust and participate in my country's development progress. And this is about the development aspect of peace, the social, political, and economic inclusion of people, ending injustice and discrimination, and building resilient societies and institutions. Human security is prioritized by people who are poor and marginalized, as even small-scale disasters and conflicts have the potential to destroy years of progress and undermine the well-being of people for years to come. This builds on the mandate given from RioPlus20 for the post-2015 development agenda, where the future we want acknowledged the centrality of democracy, good governance, the rule of law, and human rights. The post-2015 development agenda can be transformative by making people the artisans of their own destinies through enabling them to participate every step of the way, from the design and implementation to monitoring and accountability of our global commitment to end poverty through sustainable development. Thank you.
I thank Madam Neva Fresh-Phil for her participation in this part of our debate. She was quite right when she said that the agenda must be universal. It must be negotiated among all member states, and it must urge that all groups take part, groups that have been traditionally excluded when we talked about development goals. Thank you very much, too, for mentioning people with disabilities. Progress has been made at the level of norms and concepts. We've gone from just thinking about doctors helping people with disabilities to people with disabilities having rights. So we have moved forward there. But as in many of the subjects that we've taken up, the challenge ahead is very great and remains to be met. Now, I'd like to call on the Minister of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of Guinea. You have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, yesterday I had an opportunity on behalf of my government to recall the extent to which this event was important and the extent to which we see a logical link between human rights and development issues. We also recall the need, of course, to work for tangible development. Allow me today to ask some questions. I myself am a minister for human rights. We are democratizing. I'm a member of civil society. I work in an NGO defending human rights before being a minister in the government. The topic of this event, we feel, should be addressed twofold. First of all, of course, we need to ask how we can guarantee and accelerate access to development through the application or applicability of human rights and effective use of rule of law. At the second level, I think we can also ask ourselves how we can ensure that the implementation of human rights is a factor that can help us to facilitate, to build our societies for development. The lady who just spoke focused on an extremely important issue, I feel, that is the issue of context. Sometimes I feel, despite our goodwill and indisputed sincerity, sometimes we do err in the path that we take in our presentations, which don't always show the full complexity, diversity of situations. Now, for human rights and rule of law, and all the relevant comments that were just made now, all of this leads us to a central issue, that is public power and the role of the state, which of course is the primary arbiter in human rights issues and principles related to rule of law. When some human rights defenders, in goodwill, of course, and good faith, because here it's not something that I'm trying to call into question, neither legitimacy or the sincerity of the actors involved here, we're seeking to contextualize this debate. When we talk about human rights defenders and defense and the effectiveness of rule of law, there are some countries that are experiencing extremely complex situations. So what can we do to ensure human rights are upheld in societies which throughout their political history have done all they can to undermine the state systems that they've inherited since the days of colonization? I could take this, my own country, because I'm speaking on its behalf. We're living in a society which has seen a successive abuse. The state has disappeared bit by bit. Society has found itself without any symbolic or moral reference points that should have been embodied by the state. And violence substituted for this, because, of course, with the disappearance of the state, you see an increase in poverty, an extreme poverty. And over history, we saw a first period where what I would call was the pro state role, and then too little state. And now we're entering a state of democratization, which is coinciding with a time in history where states don't exactly know what options should be chosen. Should they go back to classic traditional roles for state because of the crisis, or should they reinvent a new model? And fragile states don't really know what kind of model they need to have. Therefore, the development concept, I believe, should integrate institutional issues. And the same goes for democracy. One of the speakers just now said that democracy I think it was the Minister for Foreign Affairs, or I'm not sure exactly who it was who said this, but they said that democracy, of course, means an idea. The idea is universal. It applies to all societies. Things need to adapt to context. Of course, it's the institutional form whereby democratic principles can be expressed. Promoting democratic principles are at stake. And therefore, I would like to draw your attention. I draw attention of all stakeholders fighting for promoting and protecting human rights. They need to take into account the institutional challenges in some countries. Of course, these countries adhere to human rights principles, but they are facing a certain number of institutional and political crises, which, if they are not first addressed, will not make it possible to address moral and legal issues, as well as human rights and rule of law issues. I think that this is important, and I myself had experience of working in civil society as an activist, and now I have incumbent responsibilities, and I see the extent to which fragile states, most of our states on the African continent, are. Of course, we adhere to our values, but we are experiencing difficulties in terms of establishing our institutions and knowing how to build up public authorities so that these are able to guarantee all citizens have an environment of justice, of law and freedom. And I'd like to conclude by recalling African societies, in an unprecedented fashion, are facing a situation that is the need to build democracy and rights principles. We know that historically, some states have had an opportunity to live through different periods, but we haven't had such historic opportunities. Of course, there's no excuse for us, but those who look at us from outside, we accept the criticism that they have of us. We accept their assistance as well. But of course, we're asking them to contextualize a principle to which we all adhere, because we believe that human rights are universal rights. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I thank the Minister of Human Rights of Guinea for his participation.
I thank him in particular for having emphasized the importance of strengthening the institutions of states. That means also strengthening international cooperation in this area. Thank you, Mr. Minister, very much. I have no more requests for the floor at the present time. We do have a few minutes before us before we have to take a break to get ready for the closing session. I could call on a couple of delegations at least, if anybody wishes to speak at the present time. The distinguished representative of the Russian Federation has the floor.
Thank you, Your Excellency.
We're grateful to Mr. Goldston for his high assessment of the progress made by states in the Open Working Group on the SDGs. However, we do have a different view of what's occurred in this forum. In particular, a number of states have opposed the expression of rule of law as an independent standalone goal in the SDGs. Last but not least, this occurs because, in their view, there is a risk for bringing about development assistance, a conditionality on development assistance. And such concerns are quite well justified because recently, unfortunately, we've seen an imbalanced approach to the rule of law in the organization. The focus only on national dimensions of rule of law means we're practically forgetting the international dimensions as well. We need to recall that the development of rule of law at the national level is a task that has to do with domestic affairs of states, where third states or international organizations shouldn't interfere. We're firmly convinced that every state has the right to develop its own unique model of rule of law in line with its cultural, historic, religious, and legal, ethnic, ethical, and other particularities. And this diversity for the model of rule of law makes it absolutely impossible and counterproductive to try to apply a template or model approach to any one form. Not to mention the fact that to measure rule of law at the national level is impossible. Therefore, we will continue to reject any attempts to introduce indicators on rule of law into the post-2015 development agenda. In my statement, in conclusion, one example that was referred to by Mr. Goldston regarding Afghanistan and justice systems. That was a very interesting example cited. Indeed, in the doctrine, often it's cited as a failure, this initiative is seen as a failure. And this failure occurred for one very simple reason, because there was an attempt to build justice according to a model that was foreign to local conditions. They didn't take into account the role of traditional justice systems. Therefore, once again, we need to remember that a template approach here will not be effective, and any indicators inevitably will mean that we will be trying to fit a country to a given model, and we can't support such an approach. Thank you.
I thank the distinguished representative of the Russian Federation for his comments. I think in the debate that we've had this afternoon, it's been quite clear that we should attribute great importance to the context in which we are discussing realities, and we should pay attention to the peculiarities of each state, peculiarities of every region, because it's unquestionable that the rule of law cannot be viewed just domestically. We also have to deal with the international dimension, and I would like very much to thank the distinguished representative of the Russian Federation for reminding us of how important the rule of law is internationally as well. I now call on the distinguished representative of the European Union. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much to you and to all the panelists. Thank you very much for this very rich discussion we have today. One thing is clear for us, for the post-2015 development agenda to be truly transformational and successful, human rights and the rule of law need to be an integral part of it. Human rights and the rule of law need to be mainstreams through the post-2015 development agenda. It will be essential to ensure that every future goal, target, and indicator is consistent with existing human rights obligations and rule of law principles. A rights-based approach encompassing all human rights should therefore guide the choice and formulation of goals, targets, and indicators and underpin all sectors. The rule of law is crucial and relevant for the three dimensions of sustainable development, in our view: economic, social, and environmental. It creates conditions for development by providing a framework for institutions. It ensures transparency, equity, and accountability, and it is the outcome of a legal order based on international principles and implemented in a national framework. In our view, rule of law goals and targets can be measured. It is possible to measure adherence to the rule of law by looking at practical situations. It is possible to measure elements such as whether people can access public services or whether a dispute among two citizens can be resolved peacefully. Fundamental requirements of the new framework should be accountability, transparency, and review of progress in order to make the new agenda successful in practice and not only aspirational on paper. Governments at all levels and other actors need to be held accountable. Civil society, local authorities, and the private sector also play an important role to ensure transparency. We appreciate the fact that a summary of the key messages delivered yesterday and today will be communicated to the Open Working Group on SDGs. And we thank you once again, Mr. Chairman, for this very rich and fruitful panel. Thank you.
I thank very much the distinguished representative of the European Union for his participation. And now we have completed our list of speakers. Before suspending the meeting, I'd like to express my deep appreciation to all the members of the Bureau. Your rich, your enthusiastic, your very persuasive contribution has been, as the representative of the European Union said, has been something which is really contributing to the debate and to the negotiations in the working group as we work towards sustainable development. This was, after all, our purpose. It's the purpose of the meetings of the General Assembly. We didn't want to just have a debate among ourselves. We wanted to do what we could to contribute to this process. It is perhaps the most important process going on in the United Nations in the coming months. Don't know if the members of the Bureau, if the panelists wish to speak. I don't know if anybody would like to make any final comments. Mr. Goldstein, Madame Menon, no? Well, if this is not the case, then, again, with my thanks to each and every one of you, to all the participants, I will suspend the meeting until 5:30. Thank you.
halving extreme poverty, done. But how evenly have we achieved it? The use of aggregates blurs the picture. In the South, economic growth has delivered benefits in some countries. In the North, meanwhile, the working poor are growing in numbers. How well are we doing on alleviating hunger? Tens of millions of children are still undernourished. Conflict threatens to reverse what progress there has been on many of the Millennium Development Goals. So too does climate change.
I think rule of law is very important in combating climate change because climate change exacerbates vulnerabilities. People who already may not have access to justice find themselves in an even more difficult position.
Halving extreme poverty, done. But how evenly have we achieved it? The use of aggregates blurs the picture. In the South, economic growth has delivered benefits in some countries. In the North, meanwhile, the working poor are growing in numbers. How well are we doing on alleviating hunger? Tens of millions of children are still undernourished. Conflict threatens to reverse what progress there has been on many of the Millennium Development Goals. So too does climate change.
I think rule of law is very important in combating climate change because climate change exacerbates vulnerabilities. People who already may not have access to justice find themselves in an even more difficult position. And it is an issue that can bring all countries of the world together. We're all parents, grandparents, who care about our children, and yet we are consigning our children to a very unsafe and insecure world.
C'est la responsabilité de chaque pays, de chaque État et de chaque gouvernement de pouvoir renforcer de plus les droits dans chaque secteur, dans le secteur du travail, dans la santé. Le développement n'est pas seulement la croissance, je crois que ça va être aussi le bien-être, puisque le fait de pouvoir donner la possibilité à chaque personne de pouvoir bénéficier de la richesse de son propre pays, c'est une valeur à ajouter. Et c'est ça qui fait de la qualité dans le développement d'un pays.
More often than not, decent lives are a matter of good laws.
Distinguished delegates, the closing segment that where we will hear chair summaries and remarks by the PGA will start immediately after a 5-minute video, which will start right away. Thank you.
Halving extreme poverty, done. But how evenly have we achieved it? The use of aggregates blurs the picture. In the South, economic growth has delivered benefits in some countries. In the North, meanwhile, the working poor are growing in numbers. How well are we doing on alleviating hunger? Tens of millions of children are still undernourished. Conflict threatens to reverse what progress there has been on many of the Millennium Development Goals. So too does climate change.
I think rule of law is very important in combating climate change, because climate change exacerbates vulnerabilities. People who already may not have access to justice find themselves in an even more difficult position. And it is an issue that can bring all countries of the world together. We're all parents, grandparents, who care about our children, and yet we are consigning our children to a very unsafe and insecure world.
C'est la responsabilité de chaque pays, de chaque État et de chaque gouvernement de pouvoir renforcer de plus les droits dans chaque secteur, dans le secteur du travail, dans la santé. Le développement n'est pas seulement la croissance, je crois que ça va être aussi le bien-être, puisque le fait de pouvoir donner la possibilité à chaque personne de pouvoir bénéficier de la richesse de son propre pays, c'est une valeur à ajouter. Et c'est ça qui fait... qui fait de la qualité dans le développement d'un pays.
More often than not, decent lives are a matter of good laws.
ما الممرضين هناك مش كويسين كلهم مش كويسين بيتعاملوا معانا بطريقة مش كويسة يعني قبل كده أنا شفت بعيني إن واحد كان على السرير وعمال ينادلهم عشان يدوله دواء السخونية ومات قدام عيني
دخترایی که در مکاتب و در پوانتونا درس میخوانند این روحیه داده شود که اونا وقت توانمندی مسلکی دارند میتونند که مانند مردا کار بکنند و خوبتر از مردا کار.
Human rights and rule of law are like Siamese twins. They belong together, but they also belong in a wider context. They belong to the relate to peace and security. They relate to development. There is no peace without development. There's no development without peace, and none of the above without respect of human rights and the rule of law.
From gender justice to food security to the environment, sustainable development has emerged as the umbrella concept in the post-2015 agenda. But unless it is informed by the rule of law, development is unlikely to be sustainable. The challenge is to improve lives for all, across societies and generations. For 4 millennia now, development has been linked to the rule of law. If the people in this film are to be believed, now is the time to strengthen that link, not break it.
Good evening, one and all. Welcome back. Let me begin by expressing my appreciation to all the participants in the high-level event of the General Assembly on the contributions of human rights and the rule of law in the post-2015 development agenda. We shall first hear summaries of the panel discussions by their respective chairs. Let me begin by giving the floor to the Director General of the International Development Law Organization, Ms. Irene Khan, who was the chair of Panel 1. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have the honor to present a summary of the key messages that emerged from the first panel on exploring contributions of human rights and the rule of law in supporting national and international efforts towards poverty eradication and sustainable development. We had the privilege of a keynote statement from the Deputy Secretary General, and we listened to representatives of governments, civil society, and business community. The key messages that came through were as follows. First and foremost, we need to put people at the center of development, tackle inequalities, and focus on the most vulnerable and marginalized, those who are being left behind. The lesson of the MDGs is that a stronger emphasis on rule of law and well-functioning institutions anchored in human rights would have allowed more impactful results. The speakers noted that everyone is entitled to all rights without discrimination. All human rights are interdependent and equally important, civil, political, economic, social, and cultural, including the right to development. Speakers also noted that the rule of law is not an abstract concept. Concrete elements of the rule of law can drive development at the local, national, and international level. Several examples were given of areas where the rule of law, based on human rights, has contributed to all three dimensions of sustainable development: economic, social, and environmental, in an inclusive way. Clear legal frameworks are the basis for legality, transparency, and accountability, which is essential for economic growth and business investment. But it was also noted that it is not enough for laws to be clear. They must also be fair and consistent with international human rights. Participation and accountability were noted as powerful demands of people everywhere. Open and accountable institutions are the vehicle for the delivery of services across sectors. And critical to the effectiveness of our efforts in development is to combat corruption and illicit financial flows, as they can severely undermine development. It was noted that responsibility lies across the whole sector, north and south, development actors, as well as the private sector. Access to justice was repeatedly raised as fundamental to tackling the root causes of poverty, discrimination, and violence. Legal empowerment and access to justice are critical so that people can claim their rights and gain dignity. Just governance was noted as a key demand of people. Legal identity was mentioned several times as a concrete way in which the rule of law can benefit both populations so that people are able to access services and claim rights, as well as governments who need accurate population information to be able to adequately plan services. And it was noted that when institutions and the rule of law work well, they contribute to stable, peaceful societies. A view was expressed that it is development that leads to respect for human rights and the rule of law. But it was also noted that human rights, the rule of law, and sustainable development are mutually reinforcing. And there is no instance where development has been sustained without a basis for respect for human rights and the rule of law. Good governance is important not just at the national, but also at the international level. And the international community needs to work towards a more democratic international governance framework and enhance the participation of developing countries in multilateral institutions. The issue of measurement came up. It was pointed out that there are tools for measuring the rule of law and that human rights can also provide a transparent monitoring and accountability framework with a minimum set of requirements, revealing the disparities and inequalities and showing the areas where attention needs to be focused. Some speakers highlighted the importance of acknowledging the diversity of contexts, cultures, and legal systems in which development takes place. While human rights and the aspirations for justice, security, and well-being are universal, the context is different. Rule of law and human rights are founded on universally accepted norms and standards. They can guide us to a universal, transformative, people-centered agenda, but one which must be nationally owned. There were many impassioned and impatient calls for a transformative agenda that underlines equality, justice for all, participation, and an inclusive model of development. Let me end, sir, by noting three quotations. First, one speaker said, "Let's finish the unfinished symphony." Another noted, "Human dignity is not divisible." And the third, "People are the best masters and drivers of their own development." Thank you.
I thank the chair of panel one for her summary. I now give the floor to the Undersecretary for Multilateral Affairs and Human Rights in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Mexico, His Excellency Mr. Juan Manuel Gomez Robledo. Excellency, you have the floor.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, sir. Allow me, first of all, to express thanks for the trust that you've placed in me and for asking me to moderate this roundtable today. I'd also like to congratulate you, sir, on your leadership. This is a crucial time in our deliberations as we work toward the objective of sustainable development. This is a high-level dialogue. It will unquestionably have a positive impact on our work. Again, let me say I congratulate you. This afternoon, the roundtable dealt with many subjects that Dr. Khan just mentioned as she spoke about the morning meeting, but we tried at least to emphasize the how to integrate human rights and the rule of law in the post-2015 development agenda. Our aim is to improve the way that we measure our progress. We wish to guarantee correct accountability. Again and again, it was emphasized that human rights and the rule of law do contribute to the process of development and participation, access to information, emphasis on equality, transparency, accountability. These are all fundamental principles which must guide our work as we work toward development. A number of examples were given. It was made perfectly clear that inclusive processes, equitable processes, produce good results in all areas: basic health services, education, security, etc., etc. In this context, we were given examples of how the rule of law is already included in national development strategies with clearly defined indicators. Of course, nobody questions the importance of national ownership, so to speak, in these processes. Any national process is unique, special to every country, that goes without saying, although
there are universal parameters that we all define. Some countries say that the rule of law has been a fundamental effort made in their joining the world. International institutions have also been viewed as an essential part of economic development at the national level. In some countries, rather in many countries, better access to justice has led to the empowerment of important segments of society who were marginalized, such as women or certain minorities. We've received certain examples, too, of democratization. We've been told that this goes hand in hand with a development process. Civil society, freedom of expression in civil society has been particularly useful.
Pour conclure, simplement,
I just would like to mention now a few areas that have been mentioned as areas that, where we have to focus our efforts, where we have to focus the deliberations that will be coming toward the end of November. It was felt that one of our goals should be the elimination of discriminatory laws. We should eliminate discriminatory policies and practices. There should be better access to justice and security. We should also strengthen institutions, democratic institutions, and promote accountability at all levels, the local, national, and international level. There is a right to public information about governments. This was emphasized. This is an essential requisite if we are to promote the effective participation of each and every one in the whole process of accountability. The right of ownership is important. Legal certainty and the right of ownership, these were emphasized. We should combat corruption. Then there is legal identity. That was unanimously stressed as something that's very important. And then reference was made to working conditions, including the need to eliminate new forms of slavery. Particularly, this was true in the area of child labor and in the area of migrant workers and their families. Special emphasis, too, was laid on the fact that we need to promote the rule of law at the international level. This is a very important part of our agenda. The international arena requires that we, first of all, respect the Charter of the United Nations and international law. We mustn't forget that the rule of law must also be invoked and respected by states, but also by international organizations. The rule of law at the international level requires that we establish a system of multilateral governance based on rules, rules which we are all preparing on an equal footing. Finally, Mr. President, the panel also placed much emphasis on the importance of measuring progress in human rights, although one delegation did express reservations in this connection. Thank you very much.
I thank the chair of panel two for his summary. Permit me now to make a closing statement. Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, we have now come to the conclusion of our final high-level event, which was the last in a six-part series to set the stage for the post-2015 development agenda. At the outset, I would like to thank the chairs and the panelists for their engagement and thought-provoking presentations, as well as the Secretariat staff for their excellent support. Allow me to extend my appreciation to you, the Member States, for supporting this event which many have called opportune and timely, and for sharing experiences about human rights and the rule of law, about how human rights and the rule of law have impacted development in your respective countries. While we all hail from different regions of the world with different judicial systems, the points you raise in your interventions are testimony to the importance and universality of the issues that brought us together here today. As the chairs of the panels have just shared highlights from today's sessions, I would like to call your attention to some of the main points that you, the member states, brought out yesterday during the general debate. There was general agreement that human rights and the rule of law are critical to achieve poverty eradication and sustainable development. For our development efforts to succeed, it is imperative to address both freedom from want and freedom from fear. Many noted that the realization of human rights, including the right to development and the strengthening of the rule of law and good governance, are development outcomes in their own right. We heard that the post-2015 development agenda should be transformative and people-centered, and it should be rooted in the principles of non-discrimination, equality, participation, and accountability. The most vulnerable and marginalized, including women, children, and youth, including people with disabilities, minorities, indigenous peoples, and migrants, deserve a place and a voice. Many describe how transparent and capable institutions, inclusive participation, and democratic accountability are drivers of peace and stability, equality, well-being, and sustainable and equitable use of resources. The role of good governance was underscored by a number of delegations. Indeed, it was pointed out that this was one of the priorities identified by the global citizens who have taken the My World survey to tell world leaders about the world they want. Interventions highlighted that respect for the rule of law facilitates investment and inclusive growth, promotes predictability and stability, helps to combat corruption, illicit financial flows and crime, and builds trust between the state and its citizens, as well as between the state and its development partners. In order to promote the rule of law at the national level, national ownership and adaptation to local contexts were deemed critical. At the international level, some noted the importance of strengthening global governance, including through reforms in the international decision-making bodies. The roles of civil society and of the private sector were also underscored, as several recall that people are the driving force of development. As member states share their views on how to reflect human rights and the rule of law in the upcoming development agenda, some pointed out that there is no need for a dedicated goal on human rights, arguing that human rights can support the achievement of goals and targets across the agenda, while in turn, development can promote the full realization of human rights. We also heard different perspectives on whether the rule of law should be included as a standalone goal or should be mainstream across all other goals in a cross-cutting manner. Some possible targets related to human rights and the rule of law were, inter alia, clear legal frameworks and effective and transparent institutions, access to independent justice, sustainable management of natural resources and equal property and land rights, legal identity and universal birth registration, elimination of discriminatory laws, combating corruption and illicit financial flows, strengthening a rules-based, equitable multilateral system, and respect for international law and international commitments. We were also reminded of some of the interlinkages between rights and the rule of law and other goals and targets, including gender equality, peaceful and stable societies, poverty eradication, health, disaster preparedness and response, and sustainable management of natural resources. Ladies and gentlemen, I trust that our deliberations today have brought forth useful insights on the contribution of human rights and the rule of law, and that they will inform the ongoing deliberations on the post-2015 development agenda. As a first step, a summary of the key messages will be shared with you, the Member States, and the Open Working Group in the next few days. They will also be posted on the website of my office. The next step, then, is for me to pull my own six events and other parallel but post-2015 related exercises together. To do so, I will convene a stock-taking exercise on 8th and 9th September. The objective of this exercise will be to provide inputs to the Secretary-General's synthesis report, which will be made available to Member States later this year and will serve as the basis for the intergovernmental negotiations that will take place during the 69th session of the General Assembly. It is my hope that the cherished values we have discussed during these events, and particularly over the last 2 days, namely equality, participation, and inclusiveness, will continue to inspire our efforts as we begin crafting a development agenda for the post-2015 era. For it is our collective duty to ensure that we leave no one behind on the road that leads to a sustainable future of shared prosperity for all. Thank you. This sixth and final high-level event is concluded.